The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
It's our final episode of the year, and we're looking back on a fantastic 2025.
From digs to discoveries, from guests to gold, we're doing some reminiscing on this week's Time Team podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast. Now, obviously, we've got far too many favourite bits to fit into one episode here. I mean, there's so many digs that we've been on there, Helen, guests we've interviewed, questions you've answered mainly. But we're going to give ourselves two episodes, I think, then, to try and cram in as much as possible. But even then, I think we're going to struggle.
Yes, but we'd like to hear your favourite bits from Time Team in 2025 too. Members can join our podcast chat over on Patreon.
How do you reckon then that 2025 has been for Time Team, Helen?
Oof. Well,
that sums it up, doesn't it? Oof.
Well, it's a really difficult question because it's always so fast and furious. It feels like you're going down a black ski run, really, and you just cling on and hope you get through it, and then you get down to the bottom and you're not really quite sure what's been going on or what you've been doing, or even if it's any good, but you've got from the beginning to the end and you've survived. And really, you know, we've had such amazing adventures. I've welcomed you to Sutton Hoo, and I have been also in my kind of area. I've been really enjoying what's going on at King's Lynn, which is a total once in a lifetime experience to watch what's going on there. And then we've been introduced to extraordinary geophysics at Brannadunham at Brancaster. I have found it so tricky to get my head around that, but I've learned more about geophysics this year than I've ever learned in a single year before. And then there's been loads of stuff on the water, hasn't there? Lots of stuff on ships. We've had the Mary Rose, we've had the Mortar shipwreck, we've had the Sandaye shipwreck, and of course we've had the Sutton Hoo ship reconstruction. And again, that's opened my eyes to the techniques of marine archaeology, but also I think we've heard some fantastic stuff about dendrochronology, which I no longer want to call dendrochronology. It can tell us so much. It ought to be called just dendrology, I think, because it covers so many different aspects of evidence that you can get all from trees.
Well, you've mentioned so many things there that we got up to through Time Team and things that we've done on the podcast as well. Let's start our little reminiscing by revisiting one of the many exciting excavations that we've done with Time Team in 2025. And you've mentioned it already, the biggest one by far and away was our second year at Sutton Hoo.
Yes, now that's of course a very special place for me, and we were there to finish off what we started in 2024.
We brought you podcasts from the dig site every week back in May and into June as well, in the sweltering heat as well of the Time Team Dome, where we got to speak to loads of people who were involved in the excavation. First, here's just a little snippet of our chat with Martin Carver, probably the expert on Sutton Hoo, putting the site in a bit of context.
I think it's important because it's very unusual in England. We've got very few sites that are quite so grand. But over the world, lots of people at different times built enormous mounds and furnished them with extraordinary things. So there was a belief amongst them that somebody who'd lived an interesting life or an important life ought to be buried in a way that they would be recognised in the next world. The Anglo-Saxons were newcomers to England, and they buried with grave goods. At this place, at Sutton Hoo, they start fairly modest with cremations and then graduate to these huge mounds. And they buried a big ship in a trench. And the people who dug this in 1939 were reliant on Basil Brown, who led that excavation and had a stroke of genius. One of his diggers picked up a lump and said, "Here's a piece of iron." He recognised it as a rivet which holds ships together. Having realised that he was inside a ship, he didn't feel he could start digging it, but he had a little go at it to see what there was.
We really were following in the footsteps of Basil Brown, who originally discovered the buried ships in the mounds of Sutton Hoo back in the 1930s.
Yeah, and you really felt that, I think, walking around the site, which was something that we both got to do. Here we are giving you a little tour.
Well, I think the best thing to do is to explain to you and show you that there's more than one trench here. So we're going to come out of the enclosure around trench one, and I'll just shut the door there, and I'm going to take you over to trench two. Now, we're coming slightly down the slope, and trench two is right on the edge of the flat land of Garden Field. It's right on the edge of the slope. Here we come into the fencing around trench two, slightly quieter gate there. And now you can see here what we're dealing with trench two. It is a tricky area. It's been put here because there were several geophysical anomalies, weak magnetic blobs, and that is what we're trying to characterise. That is the point of trench two. And it has been scraped and scraped and scraped by volunteers within an inch of its life. And finally, it's got Justin, the site director, who's working here, trying to sort it all out. How's it going, Justin?
Very well, thank you.
I see that you're on the bit of natural here that is causing problems because it's very soft and it's difficult to trowel, and you're trying to get rid of the plough furrows so we can see absolutely everything that's underneath.
Yes. Yeah, we're getting there. We're almost at the right level for photo cleaning so we can see what we have.
Fantastic. Now, photo cleaning is where we clean it absolutely perfectly so that there's no mess at all on it, and it looks like the most beautiful slice of cake that you've ever seen. And we take a photograph from above. We'll probably take it with a drone. We used to take it with photo towers. And the problem is we've got to be able to see these red blobs that you can just see poking out through the plough furrows. We've got to be able to find out what they are. They are definitely the geophysical anomalies, but what they actually mean in terms of archaeology, we are still a bit baffled by. But anyway, enough from trench two. Where are you, Martin?
In the trench at the moment is a line of people crouching down in high vis. They've all got trowels, they've got shovels, they've got buckets. These are our volunteers who are working here, ably assisted by Madeline and by Jules. And I wonder if I can just have a quick chat with a few of them. Hello, what's your name?
Hi, I'm Rondi Danforth. I'm here from America. I really like active archaeology. I always thought when I first started volunteering that it was sort of like active history. I really like that. And I've really been fascinated with this period of history for years and years, although I haven't been a professional archaeologist.
Brilliant. Well, keep up the good work. Carry on. I'll leave you to it. Let me move further down the line. Now, I've got to be very careful about where I'm standing because this is a proper archaeological trench that I am in. Hello, what's your name?
Hello, my name's Laura Tovey. I've come over here from Wales, but actually I was born in Woodbridge, so this is an important site for me because I love archaeology, so it's nice to come back home to do a bit of volunteering here.
a proper personal connection then for you to this place. What does it mean to be here and genuinely being in the dirt working on uncovering a real archaeological site?
A privilege, just an absolute privilege. When we turned up this morning and realised there was just four of us volunteering, and that for me was that we'd been picked out of a huge amount of people. We had to keep pressing that, keep pressing on the National Trust site to try to get the ticket to do this. And to be able to get it and both of us be able to do it together is fantastic. So it's just, yeah. Oh my goodness, Sutton who? What more can I say, Sutton who?
I know. Well, this is it, isn't it? You just have to say the name and you get an idea of just the scale of it and the privilege that it is to be here. So who are you here with?
This is my husband, Alex, yeah.
Alex, hello.
Hello.
How is it going then? Explain to me what you're doing.
Just slowly scraping back the dirt.
What sort of instruction have you been given? Because Madeline is over there who's been helping with the sort of making sure you know what you're doing and you know how to handle the trowel and everything like that. So what are you kind of looking for as you scrape with your trowel there?
Pretty much anything, you know, whatever's been turned up, because we're still in the plough soil right now, aren't we? But yeah, Madeline's been a great help, especially considering I've never done this before.
I feel like been told not to stand on the yellow sand because it's so soft. We've been told to get rid of the darker sand, which is the plough soil, to take us down to the sand that then they think is going to have something in it. So we've been told to look out for dark spots of charcoal. We've been told to look for very soft, light-coloured, sandy stuff, which could be bone. And we've been told to look for flint. So flints is the thing that they particularly worked flint. So we've been shown lots of different flints and what the bulbs might look on it after they've been hit. So the percussion table at the top of it. So we're looking for things like that, really. So we chucked a flint in that bag there, which was quite exciting. We don't think it's necessarily the right thing, but a potential find is quite exciting, so...
I think you're definitely doing the right thing, but then I know nothing about it, but you're being very, very well looked after with Time Team and all the archaeologists that are here helping you. So I'll let you carry on your work as I now try and very carefully, Helen, make my way out of this trench.
Now, those red blobs, they ended up as tree throws. The features left behind when a tree blows down or falls down and the roots pull up subsoil into the topsoil and so on, they mix it around a bit. Now, something that I learnt this year from Jimmy was why they show up as magnetic spikes, given that they are natural features. They're not actually made by humans. And Jimmy told me that it's that mixing of the topsoil and the aeration of the topsoil that allows bacteria to get to work on the tree roots. And it's thought that bacteria process the iron in the soil, and of course Sutton Hoo's got a very iron-rich soil, they process the iron in the soil and turn it into something magnetic. So our big fear from 2024 that some or all of those weak magnetic signatures would turn out to be tree throws in Trench 2 did unfortunately come to be true.
Oh no.
I know, it's really annoying. But one thing we can't forget about, though, is the Sutton Hoo Ships Company. We've been following their story with great interest, and you will hear from them on next week's episode.
I'm going to take you on a little walk with Stuart Ainsworth next, Time Team's landscape archaeologist, who is the person, really, that people would most want to go for a walk with in basically the entire country. Stuart was explaining LIDAR to me. That's the technology used to map all the lumps and bumps, to use Stuart's words, of the landscape.
Yes, I remember this. Now, Stuart had shown you an area on a LIDAR map, hadn't he, which you then headed out to see in real life to see how the two compared.
Welcome to the Mapmobile.
Yeah, we're going ahead just a few miles south of Chester. And we're going to follow up that image we were looking at on the computer screen, the one with the LIDAR. Turn that off. You're keeping that image in your head, Martin, I hope?
I am, yeah.
And we'll go and have a look at the field with those earthworks in it and see how that site starts to reveal itself and putting together the images you've seen. And with all that information, we can then start to interrogate the ground, look at the reality. And that's when it starts to get more and more like real archaeology and real investigation. like you've had plenty of practice there.
It's half the
battle being a landscape archaeologist. It's got nothing to do with maps, and it's about managing gates and fences and hedges and all the obstacles before you even get to where you want to go.
But here we are. This is the... I almost slipped in the mud. Here's the field that we were looking at on the LiDAR. And already I can see those features. I can see the lumps and the bumps in this field.
Look at the evidence. Don't try and put it into any time slot, into any category. Analysis of everything that you see, the trees, the field, and what the ground's telling you, and what those images you've got in your head from the LiDAR are telling you. You're continually working with them as evidence.
These lumps and bumps then, Stuart, this is ploughing.
These are strips which have been ploughed into the soil over generations and generations to create this pattern of what looks like corduroy on the landscape. These ridges are created by usually an ox team. As the ox team goes down, the plough behind is piling up the soil that way. Eventually you get a ridge. And these are absolutely typical size and typical form of medieval ridge and furrow ploughing.
So we know that was going on in this field. The other thing is this mystery, and I can see the mystery maybe a few hundred metres away from where we are now, and that's this big sort of ridge feature that we saw on the LiDAR, and I didn't know what it was. So shall we have a little walk over there and see if I can get any more clues?
It's really boggy.
This is a really boggy bit.
As we walk along this ridge line, we can see once we've got to it, it dips down again the other side, doesn't it? It's a massive, massive wide feature that's very, very low. Let's behave like a landscape archaeologist. I want you to get down on the ground now.
Okay.
Okay, I'm not, maybe not used to this on radio, sort of crawling
okay.
down.
We're on the ground.
I actually to get you down on your knees. Come on.
Okay, I'm here.
On. I'm lying flat on the ground. What does in the
it's wet down here.
It's wet, yeah, right. Now, look, we're on top of the ridge. Can you see now that there's a ridge on top of the ridge, but that ridge is now running away from us? That's the kind of detail that you start to look for as a landscape archaeologist. And with the LiDAR, we can exaggerate that and see these features much more clearly. But it looks here that we've got a plough ridge on top of this feature. So what does that tell you, Martin?
That the ridge was here first.
Brilliant. Right, you can get up now.
Get up now. So, now I've really got to know this feature. What am I looking at?
This big ridge underneath continues all the way for at least another 300-400 metres and then curves back down towards the river. It's like a big enclosure with an open end on the riverside. And this type of feature is really quite rare and unusual. It's effectively a fortification, probably mid to late 9th century in date, may go well into the mid 10th century. We know that from the excavated material. Could we have said that without that excavation? You see, that's the key question. Could we have dated it by looking at the landscape and the way we're looking at it? And we could have got very close to that, because we would say, from the evidence even that you've seen today, that it predates the medieval period, because it predates medieval ploughing. Then you compare its size and its location and its form with other sites that are known of a similar period. This site fits very comfortably with a number of other sites that have been excavated that you know they're of that date. So you're comparing what you see with something that you know.
It's so fascinating to hear from Stuart how he does it, but it still doesn't mean that you can reproduce it when you're just out for a walk on your own. It's needing to be there with him, isn't it? It's all that massive experience that you're getting from Stuart, that lifetime of looking and questioning and working things out.
And Stuart will notice something that you would never, it wouldn't have even occurred to you to even look at it in the first place, let alone be able to
get information about a landscape from it. And that is what's so great about being out there with him. You know, especially when he says things like, right, go on, get on your belly and tell me what you can see. Well, I would never have thought to get on my belly, let alone to think of what I could see when I was there. So it is, it's so, you learn so, so much from being out with him in the landscape. And I'm sure we're going to do that again in 2026. Looking forward to it. Shall we go international now, Helen? Because back in February, we told you about some exciting new excavations taking place in the ancient Roman city of Pompeii, which of course was buried in ash from an erupting volcano in 79 AD, preserving it perfectly for thousands of years. The latest work there was the subject of a TV documentary.
Now, the incredible preservation of Pompeii has given historians a snapshot of Roman life, and it's been really influential in colouring how we interpret Roman archaeology across the empire, even as far away as Britain. We spoke to Dr. Sophie Hay, who's from the Archaeological Park in Pompeii, and she's also a research fellow in the Institute of Classical Studies at the University of London, about the latest work.
So the excavation lies pretty much in the centre of Pompeii, and within the city walls, only two-thirds of the city has been excavated. So this excavation is right on the edge of that one-third that remains completely covered in volcanic material.
What then were some of the standout discoveries that you made in this new dig that has had people just going, wow?
Yeah, well, so many. I mean, from an individual object, I was actually in the room when they were excavating the top of the marble table, and all the objects still completely in situ, upright glass vases. There was a bronze jug, there was a lamp, a bronze lamp, all exactly as the Romans had left them.
It was extraordinary to see the glass vessels and the gold coins and jewellery not melted, whereas my view of Pompeii is that it's an incredibly hot pyroclastic flow or something. But there must have been some bits that were quite almost protected, like that small room was.
Yeah, no, the pyroclastic flow, I think we've been very general about our description of it. We've said, you know, it's 300 degrees. If it was, we wouldn't have any traces of fabrics and things like that. And when we see the casts made of the people, we can see the folds in their clothing, and the wood doesn't get incinerated. There must be pockets of lower temperatures, whereby then it means we get the remains that we do. We obviously don't get wood surviving, but we get the void where it has since decomposed.
Yeah, and the wood, the technique you used to recreate that or to find out what wooden structures would have been there is something that I'd never come across before, and it's using plaster. Can you just explain that technique and how you're able to recreate these tables and beds and chests that were in these rooms?
If anything organic, so wood, material, your sort of soft tissue essentially around your bones, gets covered completely by the ash deposit, which is the pyroclastic flow. You've got to remember, in Pompeii, there's also a very, very deep layer of pumice stone. There, we can't make a cast because pumice is like the sort of, it looks like packaging material that you'd get when you have something delivered in a cardboard box. We just get a skeleton of someone at that point. But in the ash, it forms a sort of hardened crust around whatever material it's covering. The organic material decays, decomposes, and disappears. It just leaves a void. So when we're digging, we're scraping away at the ash, and a little hole appears, and we then know that there must be a void underneath. We then pour, in this case, dental plaster. We pour that in, we wait till it sets, and then we chip away the ash around that plaster cast, and we're left with whatever was in that void. In one case, we have a rope that was coiled, and you can see the fibres in the rope. And because they're cast in white plaster, there's something very sort of ghostly about walking into a room full of this furniture, and you suddenly do sort of become really sort of apparent that this is the sort of the ghostly remains of what was here.
Can I ask you about the actual business of doing archaeology at Pompeii? Because when I was watching the documentary, obviously it features a lot of images of people scraping away and using the brushes. And I thought, goodness, it looks so easy. It was just almost trowel-in mosaic. So how easy is it to uncover things at the site of Pompeii, considering what happened to it and the reason why it is covered over in the way that it is?
Yeah, no, it's exactly like that. It is just scrape away a bit of pumice and there we go. It's not faked at all on that front. It's still a complicated site, probably not as complicated as many kind of urban archaeological digs you might go on where you've got a lens of this and a lens of that and you have to distinguish between hundreds of soil colours. But at the same time, it's really complicated because you're dealing with such a 3D jigsaw puzzle, as it were, and you're coming down from upper floors that still exist, whereas walls have collapsed. So in fact, the digging side is relatively easy, but it's the sort of engineering support and just the logistics of working out how to protect something in situ whilst allowing the dig to continue. So for instance, that bathhouse, the cold room had a big tiled roof on three sides of it that still existed. We'd love to keep the roof, but we then had to take off each tile one by one, number them so that we knew where they came from. I think although the digging looks easy and it is at certain levels, I think the whole process of digging in Pompeii from the very top down is really complicated. And it's taken a lot of work to work out how to stabilize things, keep things, prop things up. And then beyond that, how do we then display it all to the public without all this sort of scaffolding and support systems in place?
I think we often think that we know all there is to know about Pompeii, but of course it's such a huge site, such a deep site, and there is such amazing preservation there. It's so different to most sites. I just can't wait for more to come out.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
This is the Time Team Podcast, Martin Williams and Helen Geek, looking back at some of the stuff that we've done in 2025. And we've been so lucky to get out and about visiting Time Team digs up and down the country. You heard from our big project at Certain Who a little bit earlier on, but there have been so many more besides that. In next week's episode, you're actually going to hear from the geophysics work that we did at Brancaster, for example.
Earlier this year, our film about the Lincolnshire village of Norton Disney was published, and that follows Time Team's search for a long-lost medieval moated manor house. One of the features of the project was the use of test pits, so that's dozens of small square holes that were dug all around the village, including lots in people's gardens, and Martin caught up with a team of volunteers working in one of them.
I've just popped away from the tent to come into, well, someone's front garden. That's where I am right now, on the street in the village of Norton Disney. And here is, well, this is a test pit, and we've got a few volunteers here who are working away at it. Penny, Sean, Pat and Florence are here. Sean, let me come to you first of all. What's going on here?
We're just taking the first layer of turf off, and we're down to our first layer of contact. So we're just scraping back, trying to get down to 10 centimetres to clean it up and just see what we can see.
Penny, what's it like just working in somebody's front garden here in a sort of very nice bungalow?
Quite exciting. I just really hope that we find something shiny.
Let's have a chat with Florence. Hi, Florence. How old are you?
7.
You're 7 years old. Now, can you explain to me what on earth is going on here?
We're looking for things from maybe a bit in the past, and things like pots, broken bits of pots, and maybe even some brick or something.
And what sort of thing have you seen so far?
Mostly brick and stone.
Mostly brick and stone. What are you hoping you might find?
Maybe some, like, pottery and stuff.
Now, tell me how exciting this is and what you're enjoying about it.
It's really, really exciting because it's my first time and I'm really enjoying it because I get to do, like, sieving and washing stuff and finding, like, pottery.
Well, I'm going to let you get on with it. Let me very quickly, Pat, have a chat with you. Because you're one of the many volunteers on site. Why did you want to come and do this?
Just very interesting getting after I've retired. I thought I'd like to get back into my interest in history. So this is all about trying to find the medieval village of Norton Disney, really, and seeing how extensive it was. And a very community feel as well. Lovely meeting people and having those relationships over history.
Well, everybody seems very nice and everybody's making friends, but also doing some very important work as well. I can see you're uncovering something there, Sean. I don't know what that is, but I'm going to allow you to carry on working on it and continuing to uncover it here at the test pit.
Oh, that's a really lovely way of including everyone, even little Florence, who was so good at explaining things, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was great, great.
Now, test pits can be quite controversial because, like any digging, they're destructive. And if you're unlucky enough to land yours squarely over an intact archaeological feature, because it's so small, you're unlikely to be able to work out what's going on. You won't be able to see any edges. So you've got to be really careful where you use them. But in villages, particularly in gardens, where you'll never be able to squeeze in any kind of conventional trench, and you want dating evidence from all across your village. If you're looking for the rubbish thrown away by the people living there in the past and trying to get through the people who are still living there, a test pit can just tell you more than anything else.
Yeah, and it's a great way as well, aside from the archaeology that you can gain from it, it's a great way of getting a community behind your project and involved in what you're doing and connecting with the history of, in this case, Norton Disney, you know, where they lived. And I think that'll stick with them for so long, won't it? The residents, and they'll go, I know a little bit more about where I live and how my front garden kind of fits in with this wider picture. I think that's really great. Speaking of getting hands-on, actually, Helena, I wanted to talk to you about something that we do like to do on the Time Team podcast, which is explain various different archaeological processes and techniques.
Yes, from troweling to coring to aerial photography. We break down how it's done and what it can tell us. And one technique that we're using more and more on Time Team is something called flotation. And that features a big tank of water cascading through a series of sieves and buckets, all attached to a pump. The person in charge is Time Team's Naomi Supal, who explained how it all works.
This is a magnificent machine. It's like a waterfall, like a cascade. You've got a huge pool at the top, probably about, I don't know, a metre by a metre, and then it cascades down from bucket to bucket, like a waterfall.
Hello, I'm Naomi Supal. I'm Time Team's environmental archaeologist, and this is my flotation tank. We take soil samples from different features, different things that we excavate. I pour the soil in, I manually manipulate it. The silt kind of goes through my mesh here that I've got. What's left are all the sort of rocks and things that you find in soil, and also potentially artifacts. And then anything in the sample that floats, so for example, charcoal, carbonized grain, mollusks, these are things that float, come up and over into this sieve. Everything gets dried out and identified under a microscope. And if we get mollusks and grains and charcoal, we can tell all kinds of things about what's happening, not just what people were eating, but we can understand crop processing strategies. We can get an idea about different climates. I usually get some pretty cracking results. There's not been a program yet that I've not come up with something good. I shouldn't have said that, should I? The buckets that you can see underneath, so they're my sump buckets. So they allow the finer sedimentation to fall to the bottom. The pump actually recycles the water around. So that's actually what's happening. And that's why we've got this cascading system.
So what does this process allow you to discern that maybe you wouldn't have got had you not got this equipment?
It's all about the finer detail, really, because things like carbonized grain and charcoal, like if I open another one of these, may I get a bag? Okay. So if you can see inside of that, that just looks like a bag of brown sand.
Yeah, it's a bag of dirt.
There's no way of knowing what's in that, but as soon as it hits the water, anything that floats, like charcoal, is immediately apparent. And a lot of the time people say, oh, we only sample the dark areas because that's where the good stuff is. It's not necessarily the case. I have had so many samples where you've got really light brown soil or yellow soil, you know, almost looks like beach sand. No black bits, no nothing. And it's hit the water and bang, so much stuff has come up and out of it. And that's why flotation is important.
Naomi's point about not realising what's in a soil until you float it, that is a really good one. You can't tell until you look at it. But the thing that really I take away from what Naomi does is the extraordinary skills she needs for the second half of the process. You can imagine how hard it is to work out what species even a complete snail shell or grass seed is from. Imagine trying to do that with a crushed and decayed one that's been through a flotation tank. It's just the most amazing process.
Yeah, and really, really enjoyable. We've said this before, really enjoyable on a lovely hot day like we had in Sutton Hoo quite a lot, where it was boiling hot and you did just want to put your hand in a nice bit of cold water. Not so good when it's minus 12 and you're freezing
yes.
cold.
Naomi doesn't get very many visitors on a cold day either.
No,
nobody wants
poor
to go
Naomi,
and help.
Poor Naomi. We're basically done for this week. We're going to do some more of this next week, and you'll actually be able to watch some of the things we got up to as well with a special YouTube episode that'll be available to watch as well as listen to. I'm just thinking, because this is the final episode we're going to do of 2025. What do you think is going to stick with you the most about Time Team in 2025? I mean, for me, it's me and you sitting in the Time Team dome trying to record our podcast as the rain hammered down outside and it was so loud you could barely hear anybody else.
Yeah.
And then contrasting that with being in the blazing sun literally the next week and just being around people who are excited, passionate about what they're doing, what they're learning, and all the new things that they're discovering right there in front of you.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I have learned so much about radio and audio and sound and so on. And I've never really noticed before doing this podcast how important the little sounds are and how catastrophic the enormous sounds can be. Because I would just have thought, well, can't you just turn up the microphones or something and drown out the rain? But I've learned so much from you, Martin, and it's been so great to be able to introduce you to my world and to find out what you think as a complete newbie coming into this, what preconceptions you bring and what you find exciting and what you find baffling. It's been absolutely fantastic. And another thing that I'm really looking forward to is this freedom that the new way that we do time teams allows us. We can set quite long-term hairs running so that we're perhaps coming to the end of our work at Sutton Hoo, but we've set Brannad Dunham running and we've set King's Lynn running, and we know that there's going to be exciting things coming, but we haven't seen them yet. So you get such a sense of anticipation with all my favourite sites, and I expect all the other members of the time team family are all thinking how great it'll be when their pet site comes up next year as well.
Yeah, I bet they are. And just to your point about sort of learning, you know, bringing me into your world and learning things, I have learned so much. I mean, I don't think since school have I sort of had this sort of awakening to so much knowledge. And I just think how far I've come, you know, somebody who doesn't know much about archaeology and this journey you brought me on. I mean, I now understand the process of dendrochronology. I don't think I'd never even heard the word just a few months ago. So that is great. So long may that continue. Next week, we're going to do a little bit more of this, aren't we? Because we're going back down memory lane again.
We are. We'll have more of our favourite bits of the podcast, and we'll think a bit more about what 2026 has in store.
Yeah, lots of exciting stuff to look forward to. So we'll speak to you again on the next edition of the Time Team Podcast. Take care.
Goodbye.
Weight Watchers. It works for members like Jojo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com. Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.